So let me tell you about the first day when I realized that I was in way over my head when I started working for Blackwater. Literally the first day on the ground. I wasn't even on the ground. We took a plane from Jordan, and the way that you land a plane in Baghdad is not the same way you land a plane at a regular airport, right? So regular airport, you come in, man, that's a tasty target for an RPG. Absolutely not how you do it, especially not with Blackwater. So what happens is we get in this little tiny bird. It's got a cargo deck on the back that they can put down. And we fly from Jordan, and without warning, I got my laptop on my lap. I'm not even buckled in. The pilots pop up in the air, and then they start circling down like a corkscrew. That's what they call it, is a corkscrew. So it's way harder to shoot down. And I'm thinking, man, I'm going down. I'm dead. Like, I'm not even going to have any cool stories to tell anybody. I'm absolutely dead. So I finally compose myself. I start breathing. The only thing I can, like, I can liken it to is if you've ever jumped out of a plane and you hold your breath, and the skydive instructor like taps you on the head and says, breathe. That's the only thing I could think of was, holy crap, breathe. So we start leveling off, and they put the cargo hold down. And this guy walks through the plane, maybe 8 seats, and sits down on the cargo ramp with his legs down like he's this kid. And he's just like swinging his legs. And he's like, he's hooked in with a carabiner. He's got a 240 Bravo. And he's like looking out the back. And I'm like, holy cow, what in the hell did I get myself into? And we land and everything's fine. And everybody's looking at each other like, oh, that wasn't that bad. It was terrible. It was terrifying. So we've been told that we're going to get all these up armored vehicles. We're going to have like all the protection in the world. They show up, they hand us a flak vest that is so sweaty and it smells like old hot cock. Like, it is disgusting, right? So you put this on, they give you one magazine and an M4, and they say, all right, load up. Looking over, you load up, and it's this Peugeot. If you're not familiar with like a Peugeot, think of like a Jeep that has been on methamphetamine for like 5 years. Like, it is just this gross thing. It's soft skinned, and I hop in that thing, one magazine, and the driver goes, hey, if anything happens, there's a metal plate down by your feet, and you can just hold it up to the window like this. I was like, yeah, like I'm going to know that something's going on. And what's this going to do with my hand holding it? Like, absolutely nothing. And we are like going as fast as we can down Route Irish, the most bombed route in Iraq. Thank God I didn't know that at the time, or else I probably would have been like way more scared. And you always hear like, keep your head on a swivel. So I'm out there and I'm like a one-eyed dog at a sausage factory, right? Like, I'm looking everywhere. I can't figure out like who is what. There's walls all over the place. I'm like, the attack is coming at any point. And then we get into the green zone. They drop us off and they were like, all right, if you guys want, there's cold beer in the fridge. Somebody will pick you up in a few minutes. And I was like, what in the flying heck did I get myself into at 23 years old working for Blackwater? So it was like when I say it started, like, yeah, it started.
So that's a perfect way for a 23-year-old to start their adventure. That we're going to get into some of the details, but a lot of it are going to be told in your book that's probably already published or dropped when you all are hearing this episode. And the voice you're hearing, if you're not watching this on our YouTube channel, is Morgan Lorette. And you heard him mention Blackwater, and he's going to talk about his background and his experiences. And his book, Guns, Girls, and Greed, will be out by the time you hear this. But also, you can tell, we do kind of pride ourselves on the Disruptors, finding guests that actually know how to talk and tell a story and have a little more energy than the average person. So I've heard you on the Skillset Live podcast 2 or 3 years ago. And then I think you wrote for them and probably done a few other articles, if I'm not mistaken. But I want to hear more about it, and I'm not going to take up more time by running my friggin' mouth. But if you can kind of walk us through just a little bit about how you got into the whole Blackwater thing and doing that. I don't know that most people just kind of wake up one day and say, boom, I'm signing up and I'm gone. And for some listeners, they have no clue what Blackwater even means. So I may be jumping the gun there, but if you don't mind kind of explaining some of that.
Yeah, so Blackwater was a training facility in Moyock, North Carolina, which is the armpit of the universe. Like, it is disgusting. And what happened was in Iraq in 2004, the U.S. government was like, we don't want to be seen as occupiers. So they handed the state of Iraq over to the interim Iraqi government and said, okay, now it's going to be a diplomatic mission. It's no longer a war zone, right? Like, are you crapping me? Like, we're still getting bombed every day, but it's not a war zone. So they send over all these agencies, Department of State, Department of the Interior, FAA, you name it. And all these people are going to go and try to help rebuild Iraq by training the new government what to do. Well, who's going to protect those guys? They don't have their own protection units. I mean, the TSA is not going over there to protect the FAA people, I'll tell you that. So they hired a bunch of knuckle draggers like me. And we're like, can you go over there and you protect them? We'll go to Moyock, North Carolina. We'll train you up for two and a half weeks. I don't even remember what it was. And we'll send you to Iraq. Now, it's funny that you said, like, people don't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to work for Blackwater, because that's exactly how it happened.
Okay.
When I say like everything just happened as fast as possible, that's just how it went. So it was 2004. Mm-hmm. Blackwater, the only reason I even know who they were is because they had those four guys hung off the bridge in Fallujah.
Caused a
huge political like push to go in and take Fallujah. And my buddy's like, I'm going to go work for Blackwater. Now, look, I'm an Air Force Security Forces guy. Not cool. Okay. I'm an MP. Like, except when they say you're an MP, it's like you get to stand at the gate and make sure a tank isn't coming through. And then... yeah. You get to stare at planes to make sure nobody's going to steal your plane. Right? Like somebody's just going to jump over the fence and be like, I'm going to bonsai out of this KC-135 and go take it to the Caribbean. So I'm not cool, but my buddy is. He's a Force Recon Marine. He goes over there to Blackwater, literally says, hey, the first question you get at Blackwater is, do you know anybody that can come work for us? And that's how they got their recruiting, right? There was no resume. It wasn't like, I used to shoot a gun and I feel really cool. Bring me in.
Yeah.
So I get this call. I think it's like 6 a.m. Might've been 5 a.m. Cause I think it was a 3-hour time difference from the East Coast to where I was. And this guy goes, hey, this is James. And I work for Blackwater. Your buddy Tony said that you're good in the pocket. You want to come? And I was like, yes. I wasn't expecting it. I had no plan on doing it. And he's like, okay, we'll get you a flight tomorrow. And I was like, whoa. Like, I need to like move my crap out of my apartment. I need to like, I was taking college classes. Let me just finish up these college classes. And he's like, when are those done? And I was like, 2 weeks. And he's like, all right, I'm going to send you a flight. Literally a ticket's in my email. And look, my email's so old. It's like hotmail.com. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I get this ticket and I'm like, holy crap, what did I get myself into? First thing I do, I go to the mall and I buy like a knife, because I don't know. Like that's what cool guys do, right? You just buy this really cool knife. So I got this Ginsu knife that can cut through like a muffler. I don't know what it is. And then
it's got it's got matches in the handle like Rambo.
Yeah,
and a compass on it.
Oh, dude, it was straight up like Rambo style. Yeah.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
compass. I wasn't that cool.
Oh, okay.
And I buy a really cool watch because I'm going to be making so much money. It's like $550 a day the first day you get into Iraq. So I buy this really cool Casio Seek Pathfinder watch and I'm like ready to go. But as I'm walking out, I see this is the dumbest story. I see this thing that goes on your belt and it's got these little throwing knives. I've never thrown a knife in my life. Let's be honest here. Like,
yeah.
I've picked up some rocks and threw them at rabbits at this point in life,
okay. But
never threw a knife. So I buy this thing. It's the dumbest thing ever. And you put it on the back of your belt loop. And then, you know, if the poop hits the fan, you just take it out and start slinging it like you're Bruce Lee. So I got this thing on and I'm walking out with my Rambo knife and my Casio Sea Pathfinder. And I'm like, I'm ready to go to Blackwater. Next thing I know, I'm sitting in at Blackwater. It was like this little trailer and it's Navy SEALs, Recon Marines, Army Rangers, like the coolest of the cool dudes on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, what'd you do? And I was like, Air Force Security Forces. The nice thing is like, and I knew I was in over my head. So I just shut my mouth and I tried to learn from everybody. there's a lot of people that you would be shocked will come in and be like, yeah, I was a cook, combat cook in Vietnam, and they won't shut up. Like, that wasn't me. Yeah. And once you kind of prove yourself through that training, like, you can shoot, you can, like, you can communicate, you can learn fast. We were doing CQB. I had done it, like, a little bit. But once you get to that point, people are like, oh, that's Morgan. He's good in the pocket. Like let's get him. But right after, I remember my clearance came through so fast. Because, again, I'm 23 years old, and I'm, like, the all-American boy. So they come in. And they're doing the interview and they're like, have you ever smoked marijuana? And I was like, absolutely not. They're like, well, you have a DOD clearance. If I pull that, are they going to see that you smoked marijuana? And I was like, absolutely not. Dude, I smoked so much weed in high school. I can't even tell you. So that tells you how good their screening was. But, you know, I didn't have debt. A lot of people got their clearances denied because they were in debt. Look, a bunch of guys coming together to go to Iraq in a combat zone, not knowing what's going on, have not made the best life choice right then and there. And they probably didn't make the best life choices prior to that. Okay. So getting the clearance was the hardest thing. And I got the clearance like the last day, and they were like, here's your ticket to Baghdad. And I was like, wait. Well, it was Jordan, but wait. I was like, I got to go home and, like, you know, at least say goodbye to my family before I die. So I spent 3 days at home, and after that, it was like a flight direct from where I was to Germany and then to Jordan, and, like, everything just kind of, like, laid itself out, like a lotus flower opening up, right? Somebody came and picked us up, and then we went to this really nice hotel, and, dude, I'm like this white trash kid, and you go to this five-star hotel in Jordan, and I'm, like, wearing a robe, I feel all good. It, like, literally got there that night, next morning on my way to Baghdad, and it was freaking on.
So then, yeah. So I know that talking to people and experiencing things, that you are working as a private contractor. So you're getting paid by a company to go do security work. You've trained up, you get in country, you get there. Is the idea that, hey, basically you're only doing work that is effective and efficient? In other words, you're not having a whole lot of downtime that people may experience in the military, where, you know, they're kind of gearing up, they're going somewhere, and then all of a sudden they hurry up and wait, kind of thing. Was the pace like that early on when you got there? Like, you were telling the story, I mean, obviously it introduces you to that lifestyle, but was it like a fast paced kind of thing like that? Or did you have a lot of downtime, you know, where, I don't know, some people may get bored, or actually enjoyed the downtime? What was the pace like?
So compared to the Army, it was a blistering pace. But in real life, it wasn't like that. I mean, aside from getting into country, like, your first 3 days, you know, they get you your weapons, they get you your ammo, they get you your body armor, your little name badge, all that other stuff. So your first 3 days are really just kind of like figuring out what the heck is going on. And I wouldn't say, like, the military, I mean, and I was in the Army after I left Blackwater, so I can talk about this. The military is like, oh, we're gonna leave at 8 a.m and then somebody comes in and says, then be there at 7, and then, like, the platoon leader says, be there at 6, and then the platoon sergeant says, be there at 5, and you're standing there for like 8 hours doing nothing. Blackwater was big boy rules, right? Okay. You are going to start at this point. Like, we're leaving at 8. You can get there at 6:30 in the morning. You can get there at 7:55. Doesn't matter. Just be ready to rock and roll. We're going out the door. But you have to put it in perspective of, like, 2004. Okay, I was on MySpace, right? I had a Hotmail. There was no GPS. So we had those GPSs. Remember those, get a Garmin. Like, you... Those were always in Lexuses back then, right? Like, you had to have some cash for that. There were, even with the GPSs that they gave us, there were no maps on it. So Blackwater's like, oh, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put these GPSs in your vehicles, and you guys drive around to all these places, and that'll be our maps. Let me tell you, if you've ever tried to have a GPS in an armored vehicle, it doesn't exactly connect to satellites very good. And even if it does, how are you going to say, oh, that's this run? Because you're driving down Baghdad and there's a bunch of walls all of a sudden and you got to turn around and you got to go. Like, there was no way for us to even know how we were going to get from point A to point B. In the military, what you would do is you'd do a reconnaissance. Mm-hmm. You would go out the day before, you'd go out the morning before. The problem is with that is that Blackwater doesn't have the support the big army has. Mm-hmm. So every time you leave, it's like, okay, well, we could be, you know, we could be attacked. Do we really want to make this run 5, 6, 7 times in preparation for this one run? So it was, I mean, it was seat of your pants stuff, but that doesn't mean there wasn't downtime. Anybody that's deployed knows that, you know, it's 99% of like pure boredom, 1% of like pure unadulterated adrenaline. And then you live for that 1% and you just keep kind of chasing it, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things. Like, I was E5 infantry unit, but prior to 9/11. So when I got out, there still wasn't a whole lot going on in the conventional world of the military. But then when, after I graduated college and became a cop, there were officers that were leaving to go sign up for either Blackwater or some of the other training companies to go overseas and sometimes do contract work like that, or to do like security details, but they were also teaching foreign forces how to become police officers. And these were huge contracts. I say huge because some people were leaving as a patrol officer making, you know, probably $35,000, $40,000 at the time. And then they're making $85,000 to $95,000 to be in countries in Africa and other areas in the Middle East, trying to help prop up police departments and that sort of thing. So that was kind of like when I started hearing more about Blackwater and stuff like that. And then obviously, like you said, it hit the news. But it seemed like to me that when some of those guys rotated back, and not all of them obviously went to Blackwater, some of them that went to Blackwater never came back to law enforcement because I guess the money was so good and they probably networked into other jobs or whatever in that field. But it was one of those things when people were rotating back and they were saying the money can be addictive in that sense that, like, some of these people, when they went overseas, were making so much money and not having a whole lot of downtime like they would here on the job. And then finding themselves coming back and going, I want to go back. You know what I mean? Like, almost like they're realizing getting paid maybe what they're worth. I don't know if that makes sense or if you experience some of that where the money is so good doing things like that. I don't know.
The money was great. Don't get me wrong. But it was cheaper than having a soldier overseas. And everybody's like, how can you make $200,000 a year and say that it's cheaper than having a soldier overseas? You're not having to pay the soldiers housing, their medical, their medical for their family, the uptime or the ramp up time, right? Like you have this soldier in for 3 years. They do 1 year over in Iraq. You have to pay them for 3 years and pay them all those benefits. So financially, it's actually cheaper to have contractors. Now let's flip that paradigm and talk about the contractors. The moment you leave country, you don't make a dime. So you have all this money. And what did I do when I got home? I bought a Land Rover.
Right. I was gonna name a vehicle. Yeah.
I bought a Land Rover, and then I like blew all my money, like not all of it, but at the end of the day, I was looking at it like, well, I could stay home and be, you know, the broke E5 in the National Guard, or I can go back overseas. And that's the draw, right? Is that it's not only that you're making that money, but you're not making that money when you're not there. And I saw people that would just chase the dragon. They would be like, oh, I'm going to go home for 3 months. 2 weeks later, they're back. And I was like, what happened? I got bored. Yeah. I wasn't making any money, but, oh, I got this nice $70,000 Harley Davidson and I bought my wife like $80,000 ring. So I pretty much had to come back in order to pay all this crap off.
Yeah. And we definitely know that in the military, you're not getting paid anywhere close to what you're worth. You know what I mean? Like, that was one of the things that was an eye opener for me. I grew up not having a whole lot of money. So when I went in the Army, I was 17, having my 18th birthday at Fort Benning. I thought I was a rich man because I was getting paid, you know, but you go back and look at that level of pay compared to what you can make doing any other job. But you don't get those benefits and that sort of thing. Like you said, it financially can be a drain when you could potentially just pay a company to do the security handle of it or work. I guess I would look at that too in the police realm with some of these cities where you're seeing huge spikes in violent crime and the police departments are, you know, woefully understaffed now, and they're trying to figure out how to get ahead of violent crime. One of those things is like when you're putting officers on these details where they're guarding something because they're capable of guarding a perimeter for something, could you also outsource that, you know what I mean, to a private company to do that on that level and then have those officers actually use their skills to be more proactive, arresting gang members and drug dealers and that sort of thing? I just look at it like, can we keep an open mind in society about the private sector where it's almost like our society looks at, you know, government versus private sector. And so, and sometimes those overlap, and sometimes that's actually pretty smart if we're talking about taxpayers' money and you can go, hey, we can get more done and be more efficient and people safer if we use a private company to do this assignment and then do police or military or whatever to do this assignment. I don't know, but it is one of those things where people who have read and researched the quote unquote mercenary, you know, because growing up, I think you and I mean, we're not the same age, but we probably come from that same era. You know, I grew up reading Soldier of Fortune magazine. You know, yeah. What I'm like? That was like my first ability to be able to read and comprehend what I was reading. And I'm reading about mercenaries, you know, and every now and then they would do an article, you know, about Vietnam or Korea, but it was a lot of things that were going on through the world. So growing up, I heard this word mercenary and it was like, whoa, you know, like I pictured, like you were saying, like people with, you know, knives and weapons and all this and getting paid a lot of money to go do these.
Throwing knives.
Throwing knives. I'm not going to lie. When I was a kid, I used to throw the hell out of some like steak knives and stuff, trying to figure out how to do that. And like throwing stars, and you go, you know, to your flea market or to a army surplus store. I think I was probably 10 or 11 when I bought my first boot knife. I still have it. I used to sleep with it between my mattress and box spring. So I say that to say that the term mercenary, do you think it still holds, like you were kind of grinning and laughing when I was talking about it, but do you think it still holds that same, I don't know, stigma or identity now that it did when, you know, 30, 40 years ago? I mean, is it, you think?
Well, so there's a lot of people that have taken umbrage with me saying that I was a mercenary. And mm-hmm. my retort is, okay, so let me give their argument because it's valid.
Okay.
We went over there. We worked for the State Department. We were under a subcontract, which was the next contract, right? So it's arm's distance between us and the Department of State. So we were over there for the U.S. government as U.S. government soldiers. Now, all of us could have raised our hand and went back in as an E5. Mm-hmm. And we didn't. And you know why? Because of the money. Let's be mm-hmm. honest here. Like, yeah. like anybody that says they went over there because they wanted to go like help the people of Iraq and build a new society. Look, you may have had that, but that was secondary. That was not mm-hmm. the reason you went. The reason you went is $550 a day every day you were in country. Yeah. So that's why I say mercenary. But I'll push back on you on privatization of what I call morality. Police officers, military, and look, at 23, I would have been like, look, let's do it all. Let's privatize mm-hmm. everything. The problem is as I'm in Iraq, whose jurisdiction am I? Because I'm a civilian. I'm a U.S. civilian. I'm in Iraq. Am I under the laws of Iraq? Am I under the laws of the UCMJ? No, because I'm not in the military. Am I under the laws of the U.S. government? Who knows? Because I'm in a sovereign country with their own laws. And you get into this legal gray area where you are taking a lot of responsibility as that private security contractor or as that mercenary, that if something goes wrong, somebody's going to have your back. Hey, newsflash, mm-hmm. nobody's going to have your back. They're mm-hmm. going to say, you were the bad apple. This happened. Now, if you look at the privatized prison systems, you can see that over time, they don't save taxpayer money. Like that's just mm-hmm. been proven out. If you look at the private military contractors on the U.S. border, that's probably saving money because you're not training up like Border Patrol. But what happens when that private security contractor, and this is happening today, takes an unaccompanied minor that a coyote dropped, takes them, let's say, to Tennessee, they go to a nonprofit and they get sold into sex trafficking. Who are they going to blame? Are they going to blame Mallorca? Are they going to blame DHS? Or are they going to say, oh, this was the private security company? And the private security company is going to say, this person didn't check all these boxes and all this paperwork to make sure that they were getting that person to the right spot. So there is a moral ambiguity in it that I believe nobody wants to solve for, because it's not politically advantageous to say, hey, we're just throwing Morgan out there in Iraq. But don't worry, Morgan, we got your back. Like, here's a diplomatic passport. We'll get you out of country. No. Like, you are the one that's going to be thrown under the bus.
Yeah. I had a buddy that explained it a little similar to that. We've been in the Army together. He stayed in, I got out. He got to do the assignments that he wanted to do. And I won't get into all that, but that was one of the things that he and I had talked about. I was like, why doesn't everybody get out and just go the private route and make that money, you know? And he said that. He said, and the stuff he was doing was what he wanted to do. He said, the problem is you don't have the same team or resources that are going to extract you if they need to. And that's what he was saying. It was like, you literally could be left behind or cut off. And I'm not saying like the company's going to wash their hands of you, but you just don't have those resources. So it's almost like you're going in, you're doing your thing, but then if you get pinned down or, you know, convoys are getting split up during, you know, ambush, whatever, he's like, that's a real world problem. And he was like, it's for all the money in the world, it's not worth it for me. And the stuff that he had seen, he knew, I don't want to be, you know, caught over there and nobody pulling me out. I always look at solving problems though in that sense. Like you were saying, can a private company do a job that's going to be more efficient, or can they just do something to free up, you know, the government end of it, whether it's police work, the military. The main reason I say police work, and you brought up the border, is this idea often that as citizens we're told, hey, these departments are depleted. You know, the border can't be secure because we don't have enough agents or, ICE or Border Patrol. And it's like, okay, but why don't we? Can we not expand that? Or like you said, like, okay, if you need security at certain places and you have people who are highly trained and you can pay them, and if your budget gets blown, then guess what? Then the next year you're going to cut back and not hire that company or that contract, or that company is going to be in competition with another company. And then that, you know what I mean? Like that can drive down your price for that. Whereas then you could use Border Patrol to do more of the proactive end of it, or, you know, solve the problems that they have. I didn't, and I'm ignorant on that end, I didn't know they were utilizing private companies along the border like that.
No, it's crazy. The industry it hasn't gone away. Everybody thinks after Iraq and Afghanistan, they were like, it's gone. But so here's what Eric Prince did to his credit is he said, I got a bunch of guys that are already trained that can go over and they can do this job. And you guys don't have to spend all that money training you, right? How you got paid for basic training. You had resources around you, AIT, your first duty station, all that stuff, right? He's saying, I can take that window to train a Border Patrol agent or an Army infantry guy, and I can cut that down to 2.5 weeks and they can be on the ground. That's why he made money. Now, story time. There is no support as a Blackwater guy. We had those two helicopters and everybody's like, those helicopters are so cool. That was literally the only support that we would ever have if something went down. So I'm driving down to Al Hilla with this team that I don't even know this team, but my buddy's down in Al Hill and he owes me 10 grand. And I'm like, I'm gonna go get my cash. So, I'm in the trunk of this Suburban, and most of the Suburbans aren't up armored, but what they did is they put armor on the inside. And the trunk of a Suburban is not that big when you're 6'2". And when you take all that space and you cramp it down so you can put armor around you, I was like, I was like Buddha in the back, dude. Like just like a, so smashed up. We start leaving Baghdad. That's the last radio comms we had. There was no way for us to call Blackwater and say, hey, the poop hit the fan. Even if we had the helicopters, no way we could do it. Once we got close enough to Al Hilla, then we were able to communicate with them to be able to say, hey, we're, you know, you know, 20 mics out, whatever the heck it is. That time in between was just us. And when it's just you, your action and your reaction is going to be completely different than if you know that you can get some support, right? You're not going to hang out. You're not going to like hold in place. You're going to try to get out of there. You're going to start slinging lead because it's you and there's 12 people. And this happened with Blackwater. There was a convoy that was hit and there was no support and they had to just freaking figure it out and get to get to the closest base. So, and what, you know, they had injuries, they had a casualty. Like you don't have big army on the back end. And this is the other crazy thing, because a lot of people are like shocked by this. We never told big army where we were going. They had no idea. Army, Air Force, you would just be bonsaiing down the road. And the next thing you know, you're coming up on an army convoy and they're like moving their 240 Bravo towards you. And you're like, oh, bro, that's going to go through my stuff. So
yeah,
please don't. So there's no coordination. And I mean, I can go both sides of the fence, right? I can be like a free market guy and I can explain why it's good. And on the other side, I can explain why it's bad. But when you're not coordinating between all the units in an active combat zone, that's where you get into trouble. I've had more people be like, oh, I remember Blackwater. We shot at you guys. And I say, well, you guys had terrible aim because you didn't hit any of us. But it's, I mean, every day was just an adventure. So I call it the combat mullet. All right, I'll go into another story.
Okay.
This is how the book starts, and everybody's going to go on Amazon and be like, $30 for a book? I swear to God, I paid $30 for this book. And I was reading it, and I was like, this sucks. I got like a third of the way through, and I was so bummed out. You're not going to get that with this book.
Okay. Because
it starts off, and we're in Baghdad, and I'm in a Humvee, the window's down, and I'm just like sitting there with my face out like a dog waiting for like an IED to like blast my brains out. Cause what are you going to do? And we take a right-hand turn and this car starts coming up on us fast. Now, 2004, 2005, vehicle borne IEDs, car bombs, all the rage. Now, when your window is like horse blinders and you can't see anything, as soon as we turned, that car was on me. I flipped it off safe. I shot the car, popped the tire. It sounded so freaking cool, man. It was like, like it was just awesome. And then my buddy, the gunner on top, is like, I had him, dude. And I was like, how was I supposed to know? I only got this little 12 by 12 inch window. And we come into the base. We don't do AARs or any of that crap that you waste your time on in the army. We just go back to our rooms. I go and I work out, and then we go to the Saddam Hussein's pool. All that beautiful tax money that you're talking about saving, don't worry, we wasted it on the oil for food program. He had like the greatest palaces and the nicest pool. So we're at the pool, and because we're not military, we're chugging beers. And that's where I came up with the combat mullet, right? Okay. Party in the front of the day, or I'm sorry, work in the front of the day, party in the back, man. And it, that was more days than not. Like we would just go out, romp Baghdad, and then come back in and be like, yeah, I think we'll go get wasted by the pool and just hope that, you know, nothing comes up.
Now, if in my time or my dateline may be off, was that when Saddam was still basically like a fugitive and everybody was still tracking him, or was he in custody by then? I can't remember.
He was already in custody. So,
okay.
I mean, one of the cool things with Blackwater is I was on the regime crimes liaison office. So we had the CIA, FBI, DIA, all those dudes. And we protected them to go gather evidence against Saddam Hussein and Chemical Ali. Now, that's just like a cool thing to put on your resume. It doesn't matter who you are. It was pretty boring, but we would drive up to this little camp and it would change names like every 3 to 4 weeks, because apparently that's where they had all their high value targets, except for Saddam Hussein. He was over at Camp Liberty. But that's where they kept all the evidence. That's where they had the main detention facility. And that's where they hanged Saddam Hussein. So, like if you go on my Instagram and it's Blackwater Dude One, you can see where the gallows where Saddam Hussein was hanged. You can see like the detention facility. And when we got there, they used to just have judges. So there's these huge rooms that are like extremely long, like I'd say like 25 by 10. And at the end of it, there was this judge and he would sit at a desk, empty room, just a desk, and there's a shower outside of it. So what they would do is they would bring in these high value targets and they would say, okay, yeah, you got sentenced to die. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? And they're like, okay, go take a shower because you can't go see Allah if your armpits stink, right? So they would take him to the shower, go see the judge. The judge would be like, yep, nope, your appeal didn't go through in the last 4 minutes where you were out there, you know, bathing your sack, and then walk him up to the gallows and just hang him. Like when you guys, like this, the criminal justice system worked exceptionally fast for a while back in Iraq in 05.
Mm-hmm. So then, yeah. So that, time frame, there were actually 12 MPs that had to guard Saddam and they rotated, and there's been a book written about it. And, you know, we can talk offline about it, but it did talk a little bit in that book about that system. And some people would be like, hey, that's perfect. Also, I don't know. I think it also affected those MPs that guarded Saddam every day, like 8-hour shifts. So, and I didn't know that. I mean, these were like 18, 19, 20-year-old MPs. It's like you did the running joke earlier about, you know, security forces and army MPs. But to have that and to be, you know, right there thrust in the middle of history, and then they go into that, and that same team watched him, or some of them, when he was hanged. Or hung. I don't know the proper term.
I don't know. Well, Saddam was hung. Saddam was hung. That's what they say.
It's one of those things that at that time, also history will look back and how do you try to rebuild a country? And you've got sectarian violence and people were doing very specific things with explosives to pit multiple groups together. And then in the middle of all of that, you all are having to ride around and run convoys and do security and that sort of thing. When you're talking about the rules of engagement, you're talking about, you know, getting in firefights and that sort of thing. And I'm not putting you on the spot, but it's like one of those things, like you would say, like, we don't do after actions and we don't do this stuff. Is that because of the level of people that are doing that have already kind of done a lot of that stuff and have learned from it? Or was it just one of those things like, hey, we'll talk about it at some other point, or we'll shift our SOPs or like how we're doing this stuff. I was just curious, like how, you know.
No, you don't have to worry about putting me on a spot. I wrote a book. Okay. So it's not like, it's not like I got these secrets that I'm going to give you. There was no real talk about rules of engagement. Now, look, all of us came from law enforcement, military backgrounds. Like, we had a moral compass. We weren't just out there like romping down the streets and being like, oh, that kid looks like he's going to be a future terrorist. Let's get him. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not how it went. Mm-hmm. We weren't the nicest dudes on the planet. Don't get me wrong. But what happened was all that paperwork that you do, those AARs, all that stuff that you do in the military, I think technically we should have done that, like through the State Department. I know the first time I was in a shoot, I was driving the vehicle. The guy behind me was a Marine sniper, and he said something really cool. He opened up the door and was like trying to get the car back, and the car wouldn't go back. And he said something really cool, like "going hot." I don't know. I don't even remember what it was, but it was sounding so cool at the time. Yeah. And he shoots this car, and he came back and had to do paperwork and got interviewed and all this stuff. And everybody looked at everybody else, and it was like a tacit thing saying, we are not going to tell anybody next time we have a shoot, because that takes forever. Like, that's terrible. When the onus is on the people on the ground, going back to the morality thing, are you going to do paperwork for like the next 45 days to figure this out? Or are you just going to be like, yeah, it happened, whatever, and go about your business? So the rules of engagement were gray, I would say. So let me give you an example. I got John Negroponte. He's the ambassador to Iraq. Total dickhead. I know I'm not supposed to cuss, but this guy was a twat. So he is in the convoy. We're driving in Baghdad, and a car starts screaming up on us at like 30, 40 miles an hour. What do you do as a contractor to mitigate that, right? You have the most important person in Iraq, right? Think of him as being like the president of Iraq, because that's who he's hobnobbing with. Mm-hmm. Do you take that chance or do you engage that car?
Yeah.
And most people are going to say, look, I'm going to engage the vehicle. There's two reasons why. I got the most important person in Iraq. Second, I want to go home to grandma, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to get blown up because I didn't make a decision and I don't want all my dudes blown up. So in theory, you know, you go back and you do paperwork on it and you justify it, but can you really trust the government to be like, oh no, yeah, that was a good shoot versus not, when they weren't there? There's no evidence. There's no way that they're going to go out there and be like, hey, can we get some bullet casings from the ground over here? They're like, yeah, cool. I got a Rambo knife. I'll just chop your head off, right? Like, like that's where it was in 04, 05.
Okay.
So it was just morally ambiguous every day. And it was our moral compass that would kind of move us through how to act and react. And I don't know that that's good or it's bad. It's good in that you don't have the, you can't engage until you've been engaged, Stanley McChrystal, Afghanistan, 2009, whatever it was. You can't have a bullet in your saw because that would make people feel bad. And you're like, yeah, but that guy just shot at me. Now I got to go get my bullets. I got to stick them in. I got to put, So it's a hard situation for the people on the ground, fully knowing that it's your decision, but at the same time being like, is somebody going to come and look at this and say that I did the wrong thing? And soldiers have it to a certain extent, but not to the same extent that like a contractor would.
Yeah. And I would say when you're talking about having to make those split second decisions, if there are very hard line rules of engagement, also there are situations where people will say, okay, it applies here, but we didn't take into effect this. Like an example would be, you know, oftentimes you're looking at vehicles and people shooting from vehicles, right? Like you're having to engage the enemy from the car windows or from a turret if you're fortunate enough to have a gun up top. But then you can also use the vehicle as a deadly weapon. You know what I mean? Like you can run over people with that vehicle and eliminate that threat or at least reduce it. So then people would often say or could argue like that, like, okay, rules of engagement, you can fire from this vehicle, but then all of a sudden you've got an incident where you're running somebody over and people are like, well, wait, why were they getting run over? Well, this is why. And then you just have to articulate those actions. But for people who have never been in those situations, sometimes they're the first ones to have that strong opinion about, well, you just shouldn't be able to do that. And they shouldn't be, you know, kind of like you're saying, like if you tell someone they can't load their weapon. And I actually know of I won't even say the agency, but the agency it was in charge of keeping a courthouse secure. And that agency, the very top, told their deputies, you cannot have a round chambered in your pistol. Now, the logic behind that was because of some incident, some person had basically a negligent discharge. So then it was like, okay, across the board, you're just not going to have a round in the chamber. But then you have legit threats, and this courthouse had multiple murder trials going on. They had gangs infesting that city. It was a big city. And then you find out these deputies did not have a round loaded in their chambers because that's what they were being told because of that knee-jerk reaction. So I say that to say all the, like when people are second guessing sometimes rules of engagement or second guessing actions and not understanding a quick reaction. Like you said, a vehicle is speeding forward. That's not normal behavior, right? With vehicles speeding straight to you. And then you've got this package, or you've got this person you're protecting. It's like, we're going to have to react at some point. And is that going to be 5 feet away? Is that going to be, you know, 20 feet away? Like our number one threat right now is vehicle borne, you know, devices. And okay, well then we can't let this vehicle get this close. I just think that a lot of times people sitting in a very safe environment are very quick to judge those who have to make those decisions. And I can only imagine at that time too, having to make those decisions and saying we could affect the future of a country and potential fallout by reacting or not reacting.
The people you're describing, I want to call them shoot them in the knee people. They're like, why did you have to shoot that guy six times in the chest? And you, why couldn't you just shoot him in the knee? And I want to take those people out with a little like a knee replacement and put them on the range and say, can you, I want you to shoot this knee that isn't even moving.
Yes.
Like let's pretend like in a perfect world, everybody's a sharpshooter and you know, you see it in the movies and it's John Wick, right? Everybody's John Wick. That's not how the world works. Mm-mm. And it's usually those people that can't put themselves in that situation or haven't actually picked up a gun. They're like, you need to do this, right? Like, oh, don't put a chain or a round in the chamber. And it's like, there's still a safety. There's still, it's still in your holster. Like there's two or three steps. Like you still have to reach down. You still have to take it out of the holster. You got to flip it off safe. You have to like engage. There's four or five steps in there where you can like see if it's going to escalate or not. And it's frustrating.
Yeah. When you talk about the shooting in the knee, I've over, 20 plus years, I've met people from all different backgrounds, and it's interesting. The type of person who considers themselves a intellectual and well-read and that sort of thing, and maybe they got a degree or whatever, they're often the first person to say that, to give me the argument, because I'm very approachable. I love to talk about stuff with people and I don't yell and scream and get all worked up. And they often say like, okay, well, why can't you just shoot someone in the leg? And I always kind of, the first thing I say is like, why can't that person not present a deadly threat to myself or a third person? Like if I'm already having my weapon out and I'm having to either give them commands or shoot at them, they're doing something that is causing that. So here's the first thing, like put the accountability back on the person who's posing that threat. Because like you said, whether the pistol's in the holster or you've got a weapon slung across your chest or whatever, you're having to do some actions. Now you're having to engage somebody. Their actions are dictating what you're doing, whether it's over there or whether it's here. And then even if I can hit that knee or that leg that's moving, right, it's not going to stop the threat if there's a weapon in their hand. If they have a firearm, they can empty a magazine and still keep getting shot in the legs. They can empty the magazine getting shot in the center mass, their torso. Like, sadly, I've seen it happen where people are taking multiple rounds and they are still firing back. Like it, like you said, it's not like in John Wick where he's firing and doing all these moves and everything, and he's just deadly accurate. It just doesn't work that way in the real world. And sadly, what those same people that talk about like the kneecap or shoot him in the knee, they don't understand the ballistics, or they don't understand trying to hit a moving target. They don't understand now a person who has either taken an oath or been hired or whatever, or they're just the average citizen who happens to be armed and they're trying to eliminate a threat. And now they have not eliminated that threat because they're trying to shoot at a leg. And now they've got to watch someone do harm to somebody else. So the same people that talk about those like leg shots, usually I've seen my experience, never been in a street fight, never had a complete stranger come up and just steal them. You know what I mean? Like just punch them in the face. Like half the time, you don't even know why you're in a fight. Or ever witnessed, walked out of their front door and seen a dead body in the street 5 feet from their front door. And sometimes on a quarterly basis, they're having homicides in it. They don't experience that. So they live in that different realm. And sadly, those are the people too that are highly critical and also may even have positions where they can write about it, they can get in front of news cameras and talk about it. And it's like you don't understand that. The best thing that we could do as a society is have people go through simunitions training, put them in scenarios and let them work stuff out like that. So when they say, why don't you shoot them in the leg? Okay, here you go. I get a simunitions gun. You get a simunitions gun. You shoot me in the leg and I get free reign to do whatever I want to do. And then you just stitch them up. You know what I mean? Like then
It's got to be those lipstick rounds too, because those hurt. You can't do like the nice little sim rounds where you have like the Molly gear on and it's like, oh, I've been shot. And it's like, it's like laser tag, right? You can't do laser tag. You got to do the ones that hurt. So when I was training at Blackwater, and this is in the book, and I'm going to shamelessly plug it. Go check out Guns, Girls, and Greed on Amazon. Shameless plug.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
there were like I said, there was Rangers, there were SEALs, and we were doing an exercise where we were walking through a crowd, kind of pretty normal day in Baghdad. And we're walking with the principal, and we put the principal in the house, and you post security on the doors. And all of a sudden, it's like we get this radio call that says, like, the principal's been kidnapped. And me and this other guy, he's a recon Marine, just like start running towards the front door. And this former Army Ranger is sitting there, and he's like frozen. This is in training. This is in North Carolina. My God, what are you doing? So like I call him Iceman, right? Like he's he's freaking out. We run up the stairs, we clear the stairs, we get up to the top, we go into the room where the principal is like on his knees and they got like a Cimarron gun to his head. And we kind of split, right? You always try to split. So we split, he's on one side, I'm on the other, and the guy pulls the gun and shoots me in the hand. And all I could think of as I'm shooting back was, God dang, that hurt. That hurt so freaking bad, right? It was right between the knuckles, and like I got that little blister that's already populating.
Yeah.
And like I shoot him, and then in the AAR, they were like, so what happened to the guy that was at the door? And everybody looks over at him like, of course, dude, he was in Iraq with me. Like, it didn't matter. Like, we weren't going to narc him out. Yeah. But like, it's amazing how people act and react. And I guess that's kind of getting to your point, is that they assume you as law enforcement, you as military, are just cool as a cucumber, right? Like, oh, you pulled your gun and everything's fine. No, your butthole's puckered up, your adrenaline spiked. Like if you're not shaking, you've been training a whole lot, because like there's going to be a little bit of movement. You're going to see your sights like, so it. And I went to a really snooty graduate school, Tufts University. You know, so you guys all. Anybody with the snooty knows the snooty schools can be like, oh, he's educated too. He's not just a dipstick. Their world paradigm for people that go to places like that is they started going to like a really good school. Like they knew they were going to college. I was like, I'm going to roof houses. They go to a school, they go into like the Peace Corps or something where they're do-gooders because their parents have money. And then they go into this graduate school, and it's not all of them. There was like, at least there was me, at least I know that. Or they were Army officers or military officers. And I remember we were sitting in a class one day and they were like, you know what they need in Rwanda is running water and toilets. And this is like a security studies class. And I was like, maybe they should have security first, because it's really going to be hard to go take a dump in your nice new toilet when you're missing half your leg. And they were like, no, like that's not like the security situation. Like they couldn't get past the fact that they didn't have like dishwashers in Rwanda. And I'm like, well, they probably would trade two dishwashers for like their limb back. They got chopped off by the warlord. And I think you need both sides, right? And not to get into like the political and the policy, but you need both sides, because if you don't, then it swings one way or it swings the other. So you have to have those guys button heads. It's just always interesting to me, because at that college, that's where they recruit for the CIA, the DIA, the NSA, the State Department. Like all those agencies recruit from schools like that instead of like Coconino Community College, where I got my start. Right.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. No, you bring a good point, because this is kind of the battle I've fought for the last few years, talking to agencies and departments and stuff, is just that. If you're trying to hire somebody with potentially a master's degree or at least a bachelor's degree, and you're equating that to someone innately being a better police officer, you're wrong, because you can stack up and show, I can at least, officers in some of the best officers I ever worked with who would have also become the best leaders were limited because they did not have a bachelor's degree or even an associate's degree, but they had worked some type of job or some military background that allowed them to excel. So it's one of those things that, like you said, we do need both. And I love, if I have a problem I'm trying to solve, whatever that is, if it's not in my background, I'm going to find somebody that's been doing it for 15 or 20 years and ask them their perspective. But I think that the problem we run into is people don't do it the opposite. So someone has a bachelor's, master's, or PhD, and they are the expert in that field. That doesn't make them the expert in other fields. You know what I mean? So it's this idea of, I have a bachelor's degree. I'm the same way you are. I started a community college. I went to a university. My degree's in psychology. I love learning. I still read. I still study things. But also, I know what I know, but I'm willing to put that aside and say, okay, hey, how do we solve this problem? You're the expert in that field. But a lot of people are not doing that. I also want to bring up, before I forget, when you talked about getting shot in the hand with a sim round, right? People who train with firearms shoot very similar. So guess what? When we're also engaging, we're getting shot in the hand a lot. So I don't know how many times. And, you know, when my department and my co-host, who sadly is not with me today, he'll be back here soon. We've got to get our schedule straight. He trained, he worked on a unit that was scenario-based training. So the same thing with simulations. And we're seeing, you know, like, man, everybody's getting shot in the hands. And you don't wear gloves. You don't do any of that. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, people would complain and cry about it. And I'm like, nah, like, you need to know. Bam, it pops your hand. Now imagine you can't use that hand. You know, so we did a lot of, you know, one-arm drills or one-hand drills. But that idea that a lot of people forget, people who are training are shooting the same thing. So center mass is my hands when my hand around a weapon pointing at someone else. The only reason I bring that up is not everybody trains the same way. So if you're in law enforcement and hopefully you get some kind of simulations background, some kind of training like that, you need to be training using just one hand. I don't care, left hand, right hand, and expect that hand is not going to be in use during a gunfight. That goes for using your radio. Have your radio secured on your belt, secured on your lapel to your upper body so that you can use hands to navigate that. I've watched so many people want to keep their radio in one hand and their pistol in the other, and just expect that hand's going to get shot. Because when we did these simulation scenarios, and Ski's unit would study it, they would film it and study all the reactions and the commonalities. And it's like, we all train to shoot center mass and we're popping each other in our hands. And you're right. I mean, it splits the skin. It lets you know, hey, you've been hit. But also, like, hey, let's just train around that. You know what I mean? Like, let's just get it in our head that this is going to happen. I know that's a side note, but there are some people out there that are always asking for training, always asking for books and that sort of thing. So I would say, if you've got any kind of training staff or unit in your department, please focus on that and understand that's what happens.
Oh, now. Well, and you're instinctively, when you see a threat, you aim for it. And I think that mm-hmm. that's just instinctive, right? So
yeah.
Like you and I, we've trained, we know where we're going. But there's a lot of people in the military where the threat is a guy holding an AK-47 and they're mm-hmm. shooting hands, right? And even mm-hmm. the other guys on the US side, they're having a lot of hand injuries because people are aiming towards the threat, and the threat is the gun, right? Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the human. Mm-hmm. So I mean, this is just kind of a funny story. It's not even in the book, but I got done with Blackwater. I'm an intel guy up at Fort Lewis, and mm-hmm. I can't remember. They needed like 10 op 4 people. Okay. And I'm a butter bar, right? Like, everybody thinks that Morgan's never done anything in his life. Yeah. So he's like, grab some intel people. When you go out there, you'd be op 4 for the special operations guys. So the special operations guys are like, we're going to come in, we're going to raid these two buildings. You guys are going to be in the building. You guys just do whatever you do. And I'm looking at my little, it's like this little tiny intel girl, blonde hair. And she's like, do those sim rounds hurt? And I was like, nah, not even a little bit. Like, it's fine. Like, you got your shirt on. You're gonna be fine. And I'm like, dude, I just lied straight to her face, but I need her. Yeah, so yeah. I set it up to where, like, we start shooting. They're coming in. We start shooting as they come out, and then we pull back to the middle, and then we're just aiming at the fatal funnel, right? Mm-hmm, and these mm-hmm. guys, like, we're just peppering these SF guys, and they got their butt chewed so hard, but. They finally get through the door, and she's standing up, and she like drops her gun and turns her back, and they hit her like 5 times in the back. And all she said was, "F you, sir. That hurts so effing bad." And I was like, what was I supposed to tell you? It's like, I mean, here's another kind of fun story from the military. So I went to JRTC in June, and it's Fort Polk, Louisiana. It is gross. Yeah. Yeah, and all they're saying is like, drink water, drink water, drink water. And I'm an intel guy, and my intel guys aren't used to actually going out and training. So I made them do PT every day. I'm the butthole, right? Mm-hmm. So this one kid is like, I don't feel so good, sir. He's got a lisp, of course. And we pull him down from the turret, and they're like, okay, we got a heat cat. They take him into the medic, and he's like, don't let him probe me, sir. Don't let him probe me. And I was like, they won't. So anybody that doesn't know, what you do in the military is you have to get an internal temperature. And the only way to do that is take the thermometer, and you got to put it in the baby way, up the old B-hole. So he goes in there. They drop his trowel, stick that thing in his butt. And they're like, okay, well, your internal temp's okay. We don't have to medevac you. And he walks out squishy butt. He's like, you told me you wouldn't do it, sir. And I was like, dude, I would have told you that Jesus was coming down and going to hold you like a baby and like breastfeed you to get you in there, because like, you're a heat cat, bro.
That's the thing too, is like, you have to, you got to tell people sometimes like, no, that's not going to happen. Then it does. The same thing with like JRTC. When I was a brand new private, we went down there. And a buddy of mine, we captured one of the op four, which was like unheard of. And then I find out later, he's like, we do this like 9 months out of the year. We're in the field and I'm sick of it. You know? So he's like, I don't care. Let's just talk and hang out. And I'm like, I can't, like, I got to stay in the role. He's like, I'm done with that, man. So what's it like at your unit? You know, do you actually get to go to schools? He's like, I want to go to Ranger school. I want to do these things. He's like, I'm stuck on this op four rotation. But he had a dip can with what I remember to look like an albino scorpion. And I just remember thinking like, hold on, are scorpions indigenous to this area? Like, and why is it like all white? I don't know. It just freaked me out. Anyway, that's a sad story.
Dip can. Of course. But that was that's how you capture scorpions when you're like a, you know, E2, E3, you're like, I'm going to pick this thing up with my Leatherman with my tail and put it in my, well, where do I put it? It's like, well, I got this old rooster dip, right? It's like the dip you put in and your lip hurts. It feels like hamburger and you just keep licking it.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like, because we thought that would have been the coolest assignment ever, you know, to be op four, like at JRTC, like, man, that's all you get to do is just mess up these units. And he's like, yeah, it was fun for about 3 months. He's like, now I'm done. Like, I want to actually get to a unit where I can go to schools and stuff, but anyway.
Have you heard? I mean, you've heard the old adage, like, for every supermodel out there, there's a guy that's tired of like boning her, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's everywhere you go, because even after 3 months, 4 months at Blackwater, like, it became mundane, and it was like, oh, now I got to go on another run. And yeah, you got to turn it on, you got to turn it off, but like, oh, we haven't run in like 3 days, so you're bitching that you're not running, and then you're bitching when you actually have to run. And then like Harry Potter 6th book came out there. I had like 3 days off for some reason. And I read through the entire Harry Potter 6th book, and Dumbledore dies. Sorry if I just ruined it. And I'm like getting ready to cry, which is kind of a good segue that, like, I think what people don't understand with private military contractors is you spend all that time overseas, and the same thing that happens to soldiers happens to PMCs. There's the PTSD. There's the divorces. There's the, hey, I've been humping this PFC. It's not a PFC. All those things happen to you as a private military contractor, and you come back and it's just you. There's no VA. There's no like support system. You don't come back with a unit and start hanging out with your buddies. The suicide rate for PMCs is exceptionally high because they keep chasing the money. Mm-hmm. And then when they try to come back to like a normal life, they don't know what that means anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw it in like the Hurt Locker. I remember when I came home, like my girlfriend did my laundry, and I have never been in heaven the way that like that the fresh linen sheet smell on my laundry was, because everything just smells bland. You don't smell anything over there. And it's this culture shock. And as a PMC, there's just nobody that's sitting there saying, oh, let me help you here. Let me, you know, you can get counseling here. And like the VA sucks, like just to lay it out, but it's something. I think that's a really hard thing for PMCs to handle, is that your best dudes of your life, ready to give your life for these guys. you come home and what are you going to do? Text your buddy that's in Tennessee and be like, hey, how are you doing? And they're like, I'm good. Like, all right. Well, yeah. There's the end of that conversation.
Yeah. And I think too, with that, if the company you work for has any kind of incident that hits the news and is negative, now you know what I mean? Like now you also have that attached, meaning like, in other words, you come back and you've done work for Blackwater and you've been paid and you're like, I've seen stuff over there. Same thing I said, you don't have the VA, you don't have that. And then all of a sudden something could happen with that company. A news story hits and then people go, I don't know what this company is. And then now, oh, you're part of that. You're part of the problem too. You're the same way a police department can be marked or a unit in the military, you know, going all the way back to Vietnam and the My Lai massacre and stuff. So when people are attached to that unit or their identity, it's kind of like, yeah, but I didn't participate in that massacre, but I was part of that unit, you know,
It was like working for Enron when Blackwater got kicked out of Iraq. Yeah. It was like, oh, I used to work for Enron. And look, Blackwater is not on my resume. I put contractor Department of State because I don't want somebody to be like, oh, he's a savage. Don't call him back.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting you say that. So when you get out like that, now you mentioned a butter bar, and for those listening, that's a lieutenant. You said in the Army, right? You came back and then went into the Army as an officer.
Yeah. I wanted to fly helicopters. And then they said it was a 7.5 year contract to fly helicopters. And I said, I don't really want to fly helicopters that bad because I know I'm going to hate this. So I went Intel and I did like 4 years.
Oh, that's not bad at all then, yeah. Right? I would assume not bad.
No, it was a good gig.
Yeah. So now when you were over there, was there any certain music? Because we're big music fans. I've always loved music. Was there any certain music? Like you mentioned reading Harry Potter. Was there any kind of music you were listening to or just being like, yeah, this is what I'm digging?
This is my, okay. So, I mean, all of the regular stuff like Metallica, mm-hmm. you know, like the stuff that when you're getting ready to do like a battalion run and they put it on there and they're like, let's go. And then you run at like a 12-minute mile pace and your knees hurt, like all that stuff. Right.
Yeah.
You know, Megadeth and, but there's only one radio station in Iraq and it's like AFN radio. And they play like everything. Mm-hmm. So, and this is actually in the book. So I'm sitting there at the regional embassy office in Kirkuk. So this is essentially an embassy in northern Iraq. And the song comes on AFN and my buddy opens the door. He puts his kid inside. And then I'm sitting in front getting ready to like, I'm doing like my map recon, all that stuff. He goes to get food and Gwen Stefani's Holla Back Girl comes on. Like, B-A-N-A-N-A-S. And dude, it's me. I'm in an armored vehicle. Nobody can hear me. And I am just singing my ass off. Like, Gwen and I are connecting on a molecular level that cannot even be explained by man. And this guy comes over and knocks on the window. And he's like, hey, you got a hot mic. And I look and my radio's off. And I'm like, what do you, and it's going through the entire embassy. And I'm singing Gwen Stefani. And he's like, no, you got a hot mic. And I look back at my buddy's kit. And his body armor plate is hitting his radio. So he's got me hot mic'd up. And I'm like, the shit is banana. B-A-N-A-N-A. So, yeah.
That's good. So music does matter. Right?
It matters. It matters when you're blasting Gwen Stefani. And you're like, yeah.
It's always funny when people are talking about music and I mean, I listen to all kinds of different like categories or whatever, but when people look at like the, I don't know what you want to call it, like the comparison there, like you're kitted up, you're ready to go and you're listening to some Gwen Stefani. I don't know. Hey, it's more power to you. Now, when you were growing up, were you a huge music fan? Did it matter? Did you listen to Metallica and stuff like that when you were younger or no?
I did when I got like wanted to get jazzed up for wrestling, but pretty much country music. Like I listened to country music all the time growing up, and now I put on country music and it's like, we went to the river and she took off her bottoms and we had a cold beer. Like every song is the same and I can't stand it. Like I need that George Strait in my life a lot more than I need, you know, Florida Georgia Line being like, I plucked her flower. Like, dude, modern country sucks.
Yeah, I have to agree. It's funny because that was the one thing I used to say I didn't like 90s country. People would say, hey, man, you got to check out 90s country, like 1990s, that decade. And I'm like, man, the only country I would really listen to would be like old Johnny Cash, old Merle Haggard, you know, these like storytellers and people that could kind of frame a song. And Andrea and I are sitting there talking one night and playing Yahtzee, and we were talking about 90s country, and she's a huge country fan. We start playing 90s country, and all of a sudden, like all these songs, I'm like, oh, and this is a great song. I remember this song. I remember, you know, well, it was because in the 90s, late 90s, I was stationed in Fort Campbell. So I'd go to Nashville, and like all that stuff was being played in every bar and was on the radio. We actually had a radio back then and in the barracks. And I was like, oh man, all this time I've been like trash in 1990s era country, but you know, it's actually really, really good. So, but I'm with you too. I hear current country and it sounds like it's kind of the equivalent of when you find out somebody's been rapping about Bloods or Crips or doing a gangster life, and then you find out that person had nothing to do with gangs, and you know what I mean, like they're
realize pretending it's Chris Hart, you know, it's Chris Hart. You're like, yeah this guy really, really grew up in the hood, I can tell.
I will agree with you there. Like any kind of sincere music I dig. It's the same thing. Is there any artist, now you said George Strait, so I don't know if you're gonna double down on that. Is there any artist that right now, if like listeners are like, hey, I want to check out something good or something that like you would put your stamp on and say, hey, you need to listen to this, check this music out or this artist.
Oh man. Willie Walker Jr. I don't know if you've heard any of this guy's songs, and they are lewd and they are crass. Okay. He's got the song Drop 'Em Out about like showing boobs. He's got, like, you know, you got to check him out. Wheeler Walker Jr. And he's okay. Like, I mean, he was a comedian, but like his songs are really good. There's a song called Have You Ever Been Boinked by a Country Boy? There's like, I mean, it doesn't say boink, but like, right. He's got, I mean, and it's catchy. All of it is like so catchy. He's got like, send me pictures of your vagina on my phone. Like, I mean, these are good. These are good love ballads, these man. Are good.
Okay, so Wheeler Walker Jr.
It will change your life, and he will come into your consciousness, and you will never be able to get him out.
All right. So if y'all listen to Wheeler Walker Jr. and you don't dig it, just go ahead and message Morgan Lorette and let him know, hey, dude, I don't dig it. So with that being said, how can everybody reach you? You know, because people are going to buy the book, they're going to read it, they're going to listen to this show. People like to interact with our guests. So what's the easiest way people can reach you?
Instagram, at BlackwaterDude1. I'm on X at BlackwaterDude1. I'm on TikTok. You've never seen anybody shake their ass like I do. It's funny because my wife was like, you got to get on TikTok. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, no, I'm telling you, like, this is the new thing. And I was like, it's a bunch of like 17-year-old girls shaking their butt. Mm-hmm. You'd be shocked at the people on TikTok. Like, I've had more people that work for Blackwater reach out to me on TikTok and be like, oh, I remember you. Or, oh yeah, I was there at the same time. Like, it's crazy. I thought it was like a bunch of teenage girls that were like, you know, boom-ch, boom-ch. Like it's not. So yeah. Any one of those, reach out, absolutely happy to kind of talk. And I've talked to people about going into PMC. Like my first thing is don't go into PMCs if you don't have to, but if you want to, and that's going to be your career, you know, you might have to start sweeping floors, but you're going to meet people and you'll be able to move up. But yeah, it's, it's funny how many people like come out of the woodwork and it's like, mm-hmm. dude, I remember you. Like, oh, mm-hmm. hey, yeah, I was, oh, you were on the QRF. That was such a cool gig. I was like, and I was like, I don't remember anybody. They're like, do you know James? And I was like, yeah, there was a number of James, and most of them had like really cool handles. They were like, hey, caveman, woman cracker. And like, mine was always just Morgan. I was like, look, these radios are encrypted. If they can figure out who Morgan is and like stalk yeah. my family, then they deserve it. They've done a lot of work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
call me Morgan.
Good deal. Well, look, everybody, check out Morgan Lorette on Instagram, apparently on TikTok. His book, Guns, Girls, and Greed, will already be out there. You can check it out on Amazon and other places that you buy books. Morgan, I appreciate your time. I got a feeling if you have time in the future, we'll bring you back on and talk about some other stuff if you're willing to do that.
I mean, I got a 300-page book that's just all stories. And some of them are like hilarious, and some of them are like heart-wrenching, and some mm-hmm. of them are just like, wow, that's what you guys, like you were in the military, you know, those conversations mm-hmm. where you're like, if you had to sleep with one guy to save the world, and you're like, what's wrong with the world? And they're like, doesn't matter. You have to pick one guy. And it's like, okay, Clint Eastwood. And they're like, Clint Eastwood when he's young or old? And you're like, okay, hold on. Now I got to think about this.
Oh, true story. All right, y'all. Well, check out Morgan. And that's going to wrap it up for us. Disruptors out.